And welcome to the midday. I'm Norman Gilliland. We'll have the usual things going on today. Well, actually, usual things plus some unusual things. With me is one of the great young cellists of our time. His name is Joshua Roman, and he has an interesting performance history, let's say, an interesting career trajectory, but we'll be getting to that in a moment. He's in Madison today, and yesterday too, I presume. But tonight he'll be performing with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, the Haydn Cello Concerto No. 2, and there are some other things on that program also, which we can mention a little later, but at the Capitol Theater tonight in the Overture Center here in Madison, he'll be performing with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, and I would say welcome, but instead I'm going to say welcome back, Joshua. It hasn't been that long.
Not that long at all.
Let's see, November of 2012, you were performing with the University of Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra?
It was the full orchestra. We did the Dvorak Cello Concerto, and then they did a piece by Martineau after that, which was really fun.
A good Czech theme going there.
Definitely.
And before we get into one thing and another, live and otherwise, about the Haydn that you're going to be playing tonight, kind of an interesting history behind that, too. A big gap in the history, I guess.
Well, the C major cello concerto was not actually discovered until the 60s, which is crazy. And the D major cello concerto has several versions which have been made of it. So
that's the one you're playing tonight?
That's the one I'm playing tonight, right. I'm playing the Gendron edition.
But of course. And this was apparently written for a very capable cellist that was a fellow employee of Haydn's at the Esterházy estate.
He would have had to be capable. It's not typical of the cello parts that you find in chamber music of the time.
You have the sense that Haydn, which we know he did not too long after this, for the trumpet, you know, in the celebrated trumpet concerto, that he was pushing the envelope for everybody?
Yes. I mean, it's still one that is considered quite challenging technically, and it's not your first Haydn concerto. Usually you would start with the C major concerto and learn that one first. But this one covers the whole range of the cello, really, from the top all the way, from the bottom all the way to the top. And it's remarkable to think of the skill that must have stuck out from the pack back then to play this piece.
Well, that's true. The cello as a solo instrument was kind of emerging, wasn't it? Even in Haydn's time, having been kind of carrying the bass instrument for so long.
It's true. And if you look, I think one of the coolest examples of that is the Beethoven sonatas for cello and piano. If you look at the first two, that's really a piano sonata with cello obbligato in a way. The cello has a few things, but then really in 3, 4, and 5, Beethoven starts to pick up the romanticism of the cello and use it in ways that he hadn't previously thought of. And who knows what exactly inspired this besides good cello players. But, you know, Haydn is a good example of that. Bach would have been a good example of that, except people didn't really play his cello suites until Pablo Casals discovered them.
Oh, yeah, like, let's see, circa 1900 or something.
Right,
like
just around then.
And so what are some of the challenges, other than you mentioned the range, but what are some of the other challenges for the cello in that concerto?
It does all sorts of things involving big leaps, and on the cello compared to the violin, an interval takes a lot more space, you know, to go from a whole step. That, I don't know, what is that like? That's a few inches there. On the violin,
that's how we measure these intervals in larger instruments.
Exactly.
String basses, you actually measure it in feet.
Right, precisely. And with the violin, they've got millimeters going on. Well, not quite, but it's so much smaller. So anytime you have a leap or a stretch, there's even an interval like that. It's a whole tenth, which is kind of, I don't know of any other tenths in that time. It's a long way. It's a long way for your fingers to stretch.
Well, let's stretch your fingers a little bit here. In just a moment. We're going to be hearing some of your recordings that we've gathered from one place and another, and also you're going to be playing some things live. And we're going to start, actually, you've mentioned Bach already, so an interesting, what shall we say, collection of venues that you have performed in, and right. We'll get to that, too. In this case, though, this is in San Francisco at Grace Cathedral, and you have a relationship with them anyway, don't you?
I do, and I'll talk more about that as well, but as I was in Grace Cathedral, it's a building, it's a giant church, and the building is huge. If you've never been there, it's on the scale of European cathedrals, and the echo is 8.5 seconds long.
How do you accommodate for that? How do you compensate?
When I've played there, I've tried to choose music that, first of all, harmonically doesn't move too quickly. That, you know, even when the notes are moving really fast, that it stays in one sort of chordal pattern for a few seconds.
So you're not clashing with yourself.
There's inevitably going to be some clash, but to try to find that perfect point where it's just enough clash and not too much, that it's interesting and not overwhelming.
And now when you're talking about performing in a place like Grace Cathedral, you're talking about just solo cello or part of a small ensemble?
So far, I've only done solo cello. I think they could handle more, and it would be amazing. The choirs sound great in there, especially when they're doing slow stuff. And there are lots of things that would work really well in there. I did a project also with an actress, Anna Deavere Smith, there. And for that, we actually created our own space within Grace Cathedral and used as much dampening material as possible, because for the voice to articulate something in that space is really difficult, and to convey different characters as she does so well would not really work with an 8.5 second echo.
But we'll hear this 8.5 second echo in this recording that you've made,
yes,
of a prelude from the Suite Number 4 by Bach.
Thank you.
rich sound for that cello. And before we get into hearing it live, what about this instrument? You always have to ask that question. I mean, it looks like you know, one of the really, really old ones, but it doesn't go back all that far, does it, compared to some?
Well, this one, actually, that I have with me today is 1738 Montagnana.
Ah,
it's
usually
not my
1899.
Usual.
Exactly. You fooled me, no wonder. Okay.
Yeah, I think, let me think, the cello in the recording we just heard was the 1899 Degani, which I'd spent, it was so happy in 2010, because I got to say that it was 1121, like the Hobbits.
but I assume you brought the 1738 for playing Haydn?
This is a cello that I've been borrowing for almost a year, and it's by Domenico Montagnana, one of the very, very famous Venetian makers. And it was made the year after Stradivarius died, but it's a very comparable instrument, very different, but the quality is incredible, and it's very powerful and rich.
It continues to amaze me that some pretty, what would we call it, hardball contemporary music can be played on these instruments that are going on 300 years old, some of them.
Right. Well, they've always played contemporary music.
That's one way of looking at it.
This thing played, Haydn when it was contemporary, I bet. But it is, it's, you know, they stand up well to time. I try to take the best care of it that I can and treat it as a fragile thing, but at the same time, you have to remember it's been around for longer than people last. So something about how it's constructed is ready to handle a lot. And even just the tension of the strings and the bridge on the top is 160 pounds. I'm totally spitballing here, but it's a lot of pressure on the top of the cello. So it's remarkable how they're made, and of course it took hundreds of years to get to that point where they made them like this and they could stand that.
So if I were to make a cello, say I'm a great cello maker and I make one today, can I compete with an instrument that's 200 years old?
You know, there's a lot of debate about that. My personal feeling from playing cellos and noticing how they change as they're played is that you could possibly if you're an amazing maker, and let's just assume that you are, then you could make one that will eventually sound like this. But we don't know what this sounded like when it was first made.
Could have taken 100 years for it to mellow out a little.
Exactly. And you can tell when you pick up a cello that hasn't been played in a while, or a brand new cello, and it, not just you, the player, but the cello itself starts to change dramatically, especially within the first 6 months. You can see how time and the vibrations in the wood and all of those things affect the total resonant package. So it's a process.
And there's still a lot of mystery to it.
Yeah.
Well, you have a piece that you're going to play here, and it's a commissioned piece.
That's right. So the performance that we just heard was from Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. And I've been there for two separate projects, one that I mentioned with the actress Anna Deavere Smith, and the other one was with a light and visual artist, Ann Patterson, who has synesthesia and sees
colors in music.
Yes, mm-hmm. Which is really a remarkable thing. So we were doing a project together. In fact, her installation, for anyone who's perhaps listening on the West Coast or going to San Francisco, her installation is still up in Grace Cathedral, these beautiful ribbons hanging from the ceiling almost all the way down to the pews. And they commissioned her to do this as an artist in residence, and we had an opening concert for the installation, and I wrote this piece, Riding Light, to celebrate the opening. And we had it timed out with all sorts of light show type stuff and everything.
A la Scriabin, yeah.
Yeah, it was very, very cool. And played also the fourth suite as well during that performance. But the piece came out of conversations that I was having during late night improv sessions with Anne in Grace Cathedral, sometimes in almost complete darkness. And in this cavernous space, again, Grace Cathedral is, you can fit a football field in there, literally. It's huge and very, very tall. And it's just this overwhelming sense of space and darkness really got us thinking about how we were going to use light. And I came up with some musical gestures that sort of embodied various kinds of light for me, and the opening one. if you heard the Bach with the echo, you can imagine in the cavernous space of that, hearing the dovetail as those two sounds come together. But for me, that represented the beam of light sort of shooting out from absolute darkness, and the Grace Cathedral sort of representing the cosmos. And from there, all sorts of other textures and sounds, and Anna and I spent a lot of time talking about the colors of those. And the piece, for me, began to represent what could happen if you could strike, if you could catch that initial strike, that beam of light shooting out, and harness it, put a harness on the beam of light, and ride it as it goes on its journey through various atmospheres. There's one part where I think very specifically of the way light plays on the water, maybe as it comes from the moon or the stars, and the sort of twinkling and twittering sound. Twittering, that's not...
Twittering.
That's a little 21st century sneaking
good,
in.
A good audio
yeah.
sound. So all kinds of things, but mostly light-inspired.
Light-inspired, yes. A journey that is light-inspired and very, very kind of modern. It's from our time. So this is Riding Light.
Joshua Roman. Thank you. To give it its full 8.5 seconds, even though we're in a smaller place than the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco for which you wrote that. Joshua Roman with Riding Light. Now back with Joshua Roman and his cello. You've had a, well, at the ripe old age of what, 30 now?
That's right.
You've had a rather unusual career trajectory because at the age of 22, you became the principal cellist of the Seattle Symphony.
That's correct.
And so let me ask you about the audition. Was it usually you hear about these as being just blind auditions? Was that the case with the Seattle audition?
It mostly. Usually what they do for a principal audition, and I'm not sure, it might vary some from orchestra to orchestra and also for the position that's being played for. But in our case, the first two rounds were blind, and then for the finals they can see who's playing in the finals, because of course, especially in a principal position, part of it is how you physically lead the people that you're sitting around. So
was there any surprise expressed? Oh my gosh, this guy's only 22. Have we made a mistake?
I was told that there was a bit of surprise, and yes, there I was.
And a very coveted position. I mean, how many cellists do you suppose would have auditioned for that position?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, but it was they'd held that audition a couple of times before. They tried several times to find someone.
Really?
And then the same when I left, I think they had two auditions where they didn't hire anybody before they found F.A. Baltasegil, who's a wonderful cellist and friend that is now the principal cellist there.
And during those couple of years with the Seattle Symphony, what did you do as a principal cellist? Did you actually have some concertos that you performed with them?
I did. I played Shlomo by Bach, sure. And I played Vivaldi Double Concerto with Gerard Schwartz, the music director's son, Julian. And I did a piece by Maracta, Trois Pieces Concertantes, which I've unfortunately not had the chance to repeat, but Yeah, I did several things like that.
Were there other works in there during those couple of seasons that, you know, had really nice cello parts but not concerto in nature?
You know, the very, very first concert as principal cellist, Long Long was playing the gala, and he did the Paganini
variations.
Paganini variations, but the opening of the concert was the William Tell Overture.
Which, of course, starts with...
Which starts with a huge principal cello solo and then is joined by several other cellists.
Easy to forget that, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
It starts with that very...
Right. Everyone knows the famous tune in the... But the beginning, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a... Actually, I mean, it's a wonderful piece.
It is. It's very nice. It's beautiful. And it was a great way to say hello, Seattle.
And why did you say goodbye, Seattle? I mean, why did you leave after just 2 years of the Seattle Symphony principal cello, this coveted position, you strike out on your own?
Well, that's exactly it. It didn't feel so much like leaving something as going towards something else. And I, from the very beginning, knew that that was going to happen. And I don't think anyone thought otherwise. The timing of it was kind of up in the air. You know, when I first started, I thought it would take about 5 years. And the way things worked out, it was just one of those, you know, you have to go when it's time. And I had enough concerts that it was a decision between staying and missing opportunities or going and just going for it. So
that was, what, about a half a dozen years ago now?
Yeah, that was a while ago now.
So
wow.
How's it, you're implying that it's working out okay?
I like it. I was actually talking with some people the other day, and I was, you know, if I knew right then what I would be doing at this very moment, I would be very surprised about some things, but I'd be very happy. So,
well, I want to get more into some of the unusual things that you're doing, but also I want to hear some more of the things that you've recorded and in some cases under interesting circumstances. So about this Passacaglia, this is for just cello and violin?
That's correct. It's also done with violin and viola, but of course, as a cellist, I'm biased towards this version.
And actually, it doesn't say here who wrote the Passacaglia.
Handel wrote the, but
oh,
then
this
Halvorsen.
Is
this
sure,
is
the
Handel-Halvorsen, yes.
Which is a lovely piece.
It is very nice.
And you performed this under what circumstances?
Well, this particular recording is with a dear friend of mine, Vijay Gupta, Robert Vijay Gupta, who is a senior TED fellow. And this was my first TED conference when I was a TED fellow back in 2011. And they asked us to give a performance. And this was what we came up with. It's one of the most, it's one of my favorite moments that I have recorded, because his personality, Vijay's personality, is just so warm, and it really comes across in the video, and I think in the sound as well. It's a real to me a special collaboration with him.
Passacaglia by Handel and Halvorsen with my guest today, Joshua Roman, and playing the violin, Robert Gupta. Well, they liked the first half, and they liked the second half, too. A little bit of unexpected applause there in the middle of that Handel Alverson Passacaglia.
That's right.
That was my guest today, Joshua Roman, with violinist Robert Gupta. And you have been playing as some other cellists, and I guess other classically trained performers have, in some kind of interesting venues, too, unusual venues for classical music.
That's correct. And actually, I should say, last night I was getting dinner after the rehearsal, and I was recommended, the Brokaw was recommended to me.
Down on the square, right?
Yeah, I asked for some good Irish or German food. So I walked in, and just totally coincidentally, there was a classical revolution happening upstairs.
Oh, yes, right.
Which I've participated in San Francisco, and I think is one of those cool things that's doing that, you know, young people sort of just getting together in bars and playing classical music.
Not so different, I'm guessing, from the way it was, say, in Schubert's time.
Right, right. Not so different at all.
Something to be said for that.
Beer and music, it's great.
And applause at times that would be deemed inappropriate in the concert hall.
Oh, yes, yes.
How about one more?
Yes, I'm going to play now this something by the master, by Bach. So this would be the prelude from the third suite in C major.
Lovely stuff. It's, I think, probably hard for any cellist to get very far from Bach, isn't it?
It's kind of a daily thing, yes.
The kind of thing you warm up with every morning, that kind of thing?
You know, I used to actually play an entire suite every day. And
that's a good warm-up exercise. We're talking 25 minutes.
Yes, and there are stories of people who, I think, Pierre Fournier is an example, and I believe Pablo Casals as well, would play through all six every day.
Every day.
Every day. Pierre Fournier definitely did that for a while, and it's like our Bible. It's great stuff.
And something that we mentioned Casals earlier. He's the one who seems to have discovered that it was great stuff and not just technical exercises.
Right. They had languished completely unknown, and he managed to discover the Bach suites.
In a music shop.
He saw it in the window of a music shop, an old tattered copy, and practiced it for many years alone every day before he gave his first public performance.
What's the new frontier for you, for Joshua Roman?
Well, I've been really interested in sort of the idea of bringing old musicianship back, this complete musicianship. Like, if you look at the composers whose names we remember from the 18th and 19th centuries, they were all performers as well. And I've been writing music lately, as in writing like the piece I played earlier, and I have other commissioned chamber music works I'm doing right now. It's been really affecting how I interpret other people's work and how I view my voice and role as a musician.
Well, I have heard it said that it's a real advantage for a composer also to be a performer, because you can actually have a sense of how the audience reacts to the music, which I'm hoping something that should not be left out of the equation.
Well, I think there's room for every sort of, you know, we also need the experimentalists, but if you're writing music and you want to create a palpable connection with the people in front of you, then I think it can help to have that experience of being the one playing that music.
This Haydn concerto that you're playing with the chamber orchestra tonight, What do you think you might be bringing to it tonight that you didn't bring to it a week ago or a year ago?
You know, it's interesting. Now that I am writing music, when I look at a piece like the Haydn Concerto, I see it in terms of a series of decisions that Haydn made. And I see the melodies and the way he chose to have them unfold, not as something that just came out perfectly, but as conscious decisions that he was making as he composed this piece. When he could have done this, he did that. And so myself, now knowing that and knowing in some places what I perhaps might do differently, hopefully that gives me a leg up on previous me with Haydn.
I've never heard it said quite that way. Well, pleasure having you with me for this hour, Joshua Roman.
Thank you.